Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The viola, like the accordion and the banjo, is often the butt of musical jokes. Not as dramatic as its string cousins, the violin or the cello, the viola nevertheless has a beautiful sound and is a crucial part of orchestras and chamber music ensembles.
Robert Levine is the principal violist for the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra. It's a position he's held since 1987. And in those 31 years, he's more than put to rest the idea that the viola is somehow a lesser instrument. This weekend, he'll perform Ralph Vaughan Williams' beautiful piece, Flos Campi, and he stopped by the studio to chat with us about the piece and the instrument. Robert Levine, it is great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, you're here to talk about this wonderful Ralph Vaughan Williams piece that you're going to be performing with the symphony. But before we get to it, I want to talk about the viola itself. You are the first chair at the symphony, and you know, you've played in lots of other orchestras as well. What was it about the viola that drew you? Most people go for the violin. The viola is like the poor stepchild.
It's true. In many ways. It was actually a very functional choice. I started on violin, as do probably most violists. Certainly most violists did, less so now. And I developed an interest in later in high school in chamber music. But the problem with chamber music is you need a viola. And I couldn't find one. So I decided, what the heck, you know, I'll try it. And it actually worked very well for me physically because I'm, you know, tall and long arms. I liked the sound a lot. So after high school, I essentially transitioned to become a violist. And it was not with the thought of becoming a professional, because that was not something I ever intended. It was more, this is a way to meet people and play chamber music, and I'll always be in demand, and I always was, and, you know, meet girls. And I mean, you know, it was a geeky viola thing, but you actually could back then. And it was great, and I loved playing the instrument, and I loved the inner part, and, you know, I loved being popular, so I stuck with it.
The thing about the viola, besides, you know, the girls and the fame, is fame. The tone of it, the timbre of it is so rich and so warm, and I don't know if it's between that and the cello that most closely mimics the human voice, but there's something about those two inner voices.
It's a very alto voice, for sure. The cello functionally has more range. I mean, the cello can go, you know, up and do soprano, and obviously does bass, and you know, it's the bass voice in a quartet or orchestra. The viola is very much a middle voice. Not that it can't go up, but it really lives in that middle alto range. And in fact, you know, in some languages, what you see in the viola parts and scores is alto. French, for example, you know, it just
and
is.
And you're also an alto clef too, aren't you?
That's correct.
Yeah. So you got to learn another clef in addition
to
learning
another
instrument.
That took a while. yeah, it's funny. The clef, it's not it feels very unnatural and did for the longest time. I don't know why that is. It's just
well, most people, if they know music at all, they'll
you know
that
treble and bass.
Treble and
bass.
Right.
And that's what I learned. And, you know, alto clef, that was kind of a weird one. And there are little tricks for transitioning violinists that, you know, think of it in this position but play it in this position. And that works a lot of the time until you get accidentals and then you get all confused. But I figured it out eventually. So.
Well, that's good. The other thing that violists, at least historically, have put up with was a lot less music to do, lot less solo music. I mean, violins and cellos got all of the glory.
It has never been a solo instrument, and I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is the range. One is, I think, that it always was kind of a poor stepchild of the violin, and you can tell even in Baroque music, where the way they wrote it with the assumption that the violists really weren't going to be very good. So even in—
Or they didn't want to be there. They
were kind of the servants that couldn't quite master the violin, so they stuck them on viola. Even in Corelli, you know, from the Baroque, you can see where anytime the violists have a line and the cellists are free, the cellists are doubling the viola line because the composer didn't trust the violists to handle it by themselves. So there really were no solo violists at all until Paganini. And Paganini was, you know, solo violist kind of as a sideline to being a, you know, this unbelievable violin virtuoso. So although Mozart concertized on violin, he also wrote, he wrote really the first big piece for viola solo, and it wasn't viola solo, it was violin and viola. But he played viola. He liked playing viola. In fact, that was his preferred instrument in chamber music. And he wrote some wonderful chamber music for viola. And the viola parts, the great viola parts are really in chamber music, I think. Mozart, some of the Beethoven quartets. That's where the fun viola stuff is. The concerti are, for my taste, even the modern ones, not that. I mean, they're okay. One or two of them are good, but it's really chamber music where the viola shines and where the really interesting viola parts are, I think.
Well, I'm thinking of the late Beethoven quartets in particular.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody gets a break there. Everybody gets a lot of juicy stuff to play.
Right. Or you look at the late Mozart quintets, you know, with two violas. And, I mean, there's some wonderful viola moments. There's the C major, which the second movement is. It's very much like the Sinfonia Concertante. It's a duet between the first violin and first viola. And we could imagine Mozart thinking, you know, playing the viola while he was doing that, although I'm sure he wasn't because he didn't have to do that. But he was definitely thinking as a violist when he wrote that movement.
In a modern symphony now, obviously there are viola parts. There's a viola section in all modern symphonies. Do you find that people have more respect for what the instrument brings to the tone palette of the orchestra?
Yeah, it's coming. The standard of viola playing has gone up a lot, certainly in the 20th century. Actually, this, you know, the Flusscampi was written for one of the very first viola soloists, somebody who made their living on the viola, an English violist named Lionel Tertius. But there were a couple others. Paul Hindemith was actually known as a violist
I didn't know that.
There's a fascinating story about Hindemith, which speaks both to his viola and his composing. He was in England preparing for the premiere. He was going to play the premiere of the Walton Concerto, which is probably the best of the modern concerti. And King George V died. So he locked himself into a room, and overnight he composed a short four-movement piece, funeral music, Trauer music, and they played it the next day on the radio with Hindemith. You know, it was a solo. It was not a solo viola piece, viola and strings. So, you know, not only was he a really, really fine violist, but he was just an incredibly quick composer. And a lot of the core of the 20th century repertoire for viola comes from Hindemith.
Well, going back to the Flusscampi, which is what you're going to be performing on Friday and Saturday night, this is an interesting piece. I mean, it's a beautiful viola part, but you've also got an orchestra. There's an oboe part that kind of goes with you in certain parts. And then there's this chorus that is just not actually singing words, but just sound. And there are parts of it that sound like a film score.
Yep. There's not a piece like it in Vaughan Williams. Not that it doesn't sound like Vaughan Williams, because it does, but he wrote it for Lionel Tertius. One of the reasons it's on this program is that I think of all his music, this one, to me at least, shows most the influence of Ravel. He studied with Ravel. This piece was written in the 20s. He studied with Ravel before the First World War, and they became actually very good friends. Ravel said that Vaughan Williams was the only student he ever had that didn't sound anything like him. And he learned a lot from Ravel about orchestration in particular. But this piece, I think, shows more of that. It's a very delicate orchestration. It's a very small orchestra. And also the wordless chorus, of course, which Ravel used in Daphnis and Chloe. So although it doesn't sound French, it definitely doesn't sound English the way that Vaughan Williams often does. People think Flusscampi, the translation, is flower of the field. And they think, you know, oh, you know, cows and daisies in the pasture. And it's not like that at all. The reference is to the Song of Solomon. And the movements, which are all continuous, each one is prefaced in the score by a quotation from the Bible, the Song of Solomon. Although the chorus never sings any of that. So, you know, you have to bear that in mind as you go through the music. And it sounds very, I mean, some of it, there's a movement in it that sounds kind of like a very mini Ben-Hur, in fact. And some of it, you know, the end, which is beautiful, beautiful ending, that sounds maybe a little more English. But it really is a unique piece for him. He never wrote anything like it again, and it baffled people back then. I mean, all his friends went and, you know, oh, what? What is this? And it took a long time, I think, for it to catch on. And it's still, you know, because it's such a strange combination, it's not done often. I've gotten to do it a few times. But it works wonderfully well. It's just – it's a stunningly beautiful piece. It's kind of the analogy I make, it's like Bloch Shlomo except, you know, written for the viola instead of the cello and written by a English agnostic Anglican instead of, you know, a Swiss Jew. But, you know, you put the two side by side and there are definitely moments where you can tell.
You can hear that. I mean, now that you mention that, if you know the Shlomo, you hear some of the movement and some of the chordal structures,
right,
and some of the harmonies and also the Ravel influence. I mean, obviously the chorus, but the way he used the oboe,
mm-hmm,
that's also,
mm-hmm,
very Ravel.
That's an interesting moment too, because he was great friends with Gustav Holst. You know, they did a lot of their exploration of folk music together. And, you know, they would, I think, bounce stuff off each other. Holst, later in his life, became very interested in the concept of polytonality, which is essentially you have two different keys going on at the same time. And this is one of the best instances of that in von Weems. The opening, in fact, the oboe starts in one key and the viola comes in a completely different one. It doesn't clash, although if you look on a paper, it does. But it's very disorienting at first because you don't, you know, you're wondering kind of what's going on, and yet it's not ugly. It's just disorienting. It's just a little unmoored. The other thing I found interesting about this piece, von Weems was a big fan of Jan Sibelius. He didn't like Beethoven at all, which was really funny. He loved Bach, but he loved Sibelius. In fact, his Fifth Symphony, on the score it says, dedicated to Jan Sibelius without permission. But one of the things he got from Sibelius, I think, and this piece is a really good example, is the idea that the whole piece grows out of a kernel at the beginning. And a lot of this piece you can really trace back to that opening duo between the oboe and the viola, which goes on for four bars, you know, maybe 15, 20 seconds. And a lot of the melodic material back then, if you look at it carefully, you can trace it back to that interval, you know, the fifth or maybe the augmented fourth that, you know, that gives it its little exoticism and both going on at the same time. And I've not seen that remarked on. I don't think I'm making that up. You know, it's often easy when you do that to – you can say, well, everything's kind of a little like something else. But I think that was deliberate with him. I mean, it's a very – you know, the melodic material is – it's very tightly constructed.
Can we hear a little
sure,
bit?
Sure, sure.
I know we don't have the chorus and the oboe and the rest of the orchestra, but to get kind of a taste, also just to hear the viola in here is a lovely thing.
So the opening, the oboe part goes. And then the viola comes in a completely different key. The oboe goes back, and the viola. So the viola, the oboe is doing it in fifths and fourths, in a very normal, and the viola goes that augmented instead of. So you get that kind of very exotic quality and a little disorienting because you've got the dissonance between, and the viola comes.
You know, I think with the cello, I always think the cello, there's like a longing in a cello,
mm-hmm,
sound. There's like an ache.
Mm-hmm.
The viola is more melancholy.
Mm-hmm.
It's there, but as you say, it's not as big. It's not as dramatic. It's not as like hand to brow,
right,
you know. But the emotion is there. It's just maybe more concentrated,
right,
and more understated.
And definitely subtle.
Yeah.
You know, violin and violinists are not subtle. they all tell viola jokes, and we try to tell violin jokes back. Fortunately, there are way too many viola jokes that got out of the box.
First, so. Yes.
Oh, it did, yeah. And we still fight them off.
Well, Robert Levine, it has been such a pleasure to have you in the studio. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Robert Levine is the principal violist for the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra. He'll perform Ralph Vaughan Williams' Flos Campi this Saturday and Sunday at the Marcus Center for the Performing Arts. There is more information about the concert at wuwm.com.